Hello and welcome to Chalk Talk. Today we've got Sarah Griswood talking about the Game of Queens.
Okay, very nice to see so many of you here. And I really need to start with a preemptive strike of an apology. This was always going to be a confusing evening. You've got, or tea time, a century of history, 16 protagonists, 5 different countries, and that's before you hit me. I spent last winter writing speaking about 2 books. One of them was this one, Game of Queens. The other was a biography of Beatrix Potter. And I did at one stage wind up telling a polite but puzzled audience in the Lake District that Peter Rabbit was printed privately in 1501. But, honestly, but look on the bright side, at least I didn't say it was written by Catherine de Medici. So, the girl who arrived at the court of the Netherlands in the 1513 was herself a courtier's daughter. So she'd have known that even she might have had, she'd have had a part to play in the advancement of her family, and might even have had a small part to play in the great chess game that was European politics. But no one, herself included, could have had the faintest idea how big a part that would be. She came to a world of culture and luxury, of cabinets of curiosities like this modern one, where the inventories show one picture on the walls as Ernoul Le Fin, what we know as the Arnolfini portrait. But, I mean, she'd been lucky. But, at the same time, perhaps no journey she'd make in her life, maybe not even the final one, would have been more intimidating, if you like, than this one. Because just 12 years old, she'd been handed over to a stranger and escorted from her home in the Weald of Kent to make the rare journey across the sea from Hever Castle. Because, of course, the girl's name was Anne Boleyn. And the lessons that she learnt in her continental education would change the course of history. The 16th century saw an explosion of female rule. Large chunks of Europe were under the hand of either a reigning queen or of a female regent, mothers and daughters, mentors and protégés. And this is the bit... I always say you need to look at till your eyeballs pop. I was terrified of saying that when I did an American tour in case someone went to an oculist and sued me. Anyhow, we have... The book traces a passage of power, or lessons in power, if you like. You see Isabella of Castile here, we all know, is Ferdinand and Isabella, and who was really, you might say, you know, the one who kicked it all off. Isabella must have passed on lessons to her daughter, Catherine of Aragon, whose own daughter, of course, was Mary Tudor. But there are relations here other than the blood ones. Isabella of Castile was at one time mother-in-law to Margaret of Austria, about who we'll be hearing, who was herself a mentor, helped raise Anne Boleyn, we know of Anne's daughter. Yet at the same time, Margaret had herself been raised, now in France, partly under Anne de Beaujeu, the regent of France, Isabella's contemporary. And Anne also raised Louise of Savoy, who would become regent of France, whose daughters would both be queens. I'm sorry, I swear, this will get a little bit more familiar as we go on. But we need to remember, if we look at a map of Europe at the same time, that there are there's 3 different territories we're talking about here, effectively, and a large part of the course of the 16th century was to do with the battle between the French territories here, including even, you know, sort of semi-independent kingdoms like Navarre, the territories that came into the hands of the Spanish Habsburgs, so Spain itself, the Spanish Netherlands, the Holy Roman Empire here, and indeed much of Italy. And England was, of course, in the enviable but edgy position of often having to hold a balance between the two. So that's the background, which I'm sure you all know already. But what we do also need to remember is that in the 16th century, if you wanted to take over Europe, you had two ways of doing it. One was to get yourself an army. The other was to get your daughter, sister, even mother, and an engagement ring. Time and time again, these women would find themselves married off, you know, in their family's interests to cement a treaty, which meant often, of course, married to what had very recently been an enemy country. Trouble is, then very often war broke out again, and they found themselves very, very awkwardly placed, you know, caught in these complete conflicting loyalties, loyalty to their marital and to their natal families. Perhaps that's why these women did tend to keep up bonds with each other. They did recognise a sisterhood, if you like, even if the word is too modern. And they would often have alliances across the boundaries of, sometimes even against the interests of, the families into which they'd married. And there was a real consciousness that this was an age of queens. It was, to me at least, no coincidence that it was in the reign and in the kingdom of Isabella of Castile that the queen in the game of chess takes on the powers that we know today. Before this, the queen had been a piece like a modern pawn, able to move only one square at a time. Now, suddenly, she becomes one of the most powerful pieces on the board. And what we have here a picture, we think, of Marguerite of Navarre playing chess with her brother. They were very, and that's the frontispiece of a book called L'Échec d'Amour, Lover's Chess. They were very, very much aware of the symbolism of it themselves. And I may say the title of my book, Game of Queens, of course any resemblance to a certain well-known television series is not remotely coincidental, sorry, but it is also to do with this, the chess game. As you map out the connections between these women in your minds, a sort of, you know, all-female family tree, two women in particular stand out, or they do to me, a mentor and a protégé. The name of the protégé, Anne Boleyn, is a household one. But the name of the mentor is far less well-known than she should be, at least in the English-speaking countries, because we have, I think, tended to be quite bad at anything that's not what you might call English-speaking history. Anne Boleyn arrived in the Netherlands, then 1513, as one of the 18 maids of honour, waiting upon Margaret of Austria, the regent of the Netherlands. Whatever you do, place yourself in the service of a lady who's well-regarded, who's constant, and who has good judgment, one of Margaret's own mentors, the French governor Anne de Beaujeu had advised. And Anne de Beaujeu actually wrote a manual of instruction for powerful women, Letters to My Daughter. So Margaret of Austria could hardly have fallen into better hands. And Anne Boleyn falling into Margaret's own. Because Margaret of Austria knew an extraordinary series of female role models. Her own mother had been Mary, the ruling Duchess of Burgundy. She died when Margaret's infancy, but a marriage contract with the young King of France took Margaret to that country, where she was indeed raised by the formidable Anne de Beaujeu. Sorry, that's the young Margaret. Anne de Beaujeu, looking really rather formidable, in the lovely chateaus of the Loire. That French marriage would never come to fruition. Margaret would be dumped for a bigger heiress, basically. But the failure in itself opened up the way for a new contract between Margaret and Juan, son of those famous Spanish rulers, Ferdinand and Isabella, who we have here. And if one can, in writing a book like this, if one can play favourites, Margaret is my favourite. And part of the reason is this. On the way to Spain, to that Spanish marriage, in the Bay of Biscay, her ship ran into trouble. really almost foundered. Everyone around was terrified, but Margaret, we are told, took time out to compose for herself a rhyming epitaph. Here lies Margaret, the willing bride, twice married, yet a virgin when she died. I mean, anyone who can do that under those circumstances has my vote. Margaret's Spanish marriage also ended early with Juan's death. They said that he was worn out by his exertions with the hot-blooded Margaret. But Margaret's third marriage to the Duke of Savoy let her exercise power directly before, still young, but three marriages to the bad. He died too. I mean, she really wasn't lucky in her husbands, was she? Her family summoned her back to take up the Netherlands regency. And when Anne Boleyn arrived at her court, Margaret of Austria, in her early 30s, was already several years into that government, which she exercised there during the minority of her nephew, the future Charles V. But what's more than that, she was also, outside the Netherlands even, at the very heart of European diplomacy. As her one-time father-in-law, Ferdinand of Aragon, put it, "Madame Margaret is the most important person in Christendom, since she acts as mediator in almost all the negotiations between the princes." So at this court, where Margaret of Austria consulted with her council every day, Anne Boleyn would have observed, just as Margaret herself had observed in France and Spain, a woman exercising power in a way still unfamiliar in England. We were lagging behind a bit here. But there was another lesson that Anne Boleyn could have learnt at Margaret's court in that, you know, glamorous, cultivated sphere. The Netherlands, the old Burgundian court, was home to all the pageantry and parade of courtly love, that great game of sexual role play, if you like, which dominated upper class Europe for three centuries. C.S. Lewis, we all know him, of course, as the creator of Narnia, but he was also, you know, a very major medievalist. He wrote that courtly love was a movement compared to which the Renaissance was a mere ripple on the surface of literature. So, this too was a game which Anne Boleyn, very importantly, would learn how to play. Her time in the Netherlands was actually comparatively brief, but only because the experience of another European court was coming her way. When, in 1514, Henry VIII's younger sister, Mary Tudor, travelled to the French court to marry old King Louis, Anne Boleyn was one of the English ladies who came to join her, remaining in France, moreover, long after Princess Mary had danced her elderly husband into his grave and herself gone back to England. Claude, wife to the new king, François I, was a sort of fairly uncharismatic figure, quite honestly. But for all of that, Anne Boleyn was now in the sphere of some extraordinary ladies. First among them was the king's mother, Louise of Savoy. A distant relative of the French royal family, she, like Margaret of Austria, had been raised in the care of Anne de Beaujeu, you know, that one who wrote the manual for powerful women. But Louise had also seen her adored son François move closer and closer to the throne as one French king after another died without direct heir. François was a pleasure-loving 20-year-old when he inherited France's crown, but that just meant that in the day-to-day business of government, his mother Louise had still an important role to play. I mean, someone wrote back to Henry VIII that he's she who runs all, and so may she well. A Venetian envoy was told that Louise of Savoy lays claim to managing everything. But there was a third member of a family group, the French royal family, so close they were known as the Trinity, and that was Louise's daughter, Marguerite of Navarre, who exercised a huge influence at her brother's court, and perhaps on the young Anne Boleyn. I mean, Marguerite was a complex character. She's been called a people's princess. Where have we heard that phrase before? And she likewise had a difficult and complex emotional history. I mean, they really were a remarkably close family, to the degree that when Marguerite, after many, many years, was pregnant at last, she writes letters to her brother saying how much she hates the baby in her womb because it may distract her from attention paid to him, to her brother. No wonder various historians at various times have speculated that the relationship was incestuously close physically as it was emotionally. That's probably going too far, but, you know, there is no doubt that she was a complex woman. She was the author of another number of published works, notably this one, The Heptameron, but she was also, significantly, a leader among the quite large group of aristocratic women seeking to reform the Catholic Church from within, because, of course, these were the years of the dawning of the Reformation. Luther, the Pope. And, of course, we're looking back with hindsight. To us, Anne Boleyn is associated forever with the Reformation with a capital R, you know, the actual break of the Church of England from the Church of Rome. But no one knew that at the time. At the time, a number of aristocratic ladies, you know, really did want to reform the abuses of the Catholic Church, wanted even to promote a kind of more emotional, if you like, a more spiritual kind of Christianity, less tied to forms, but they would remain loyal daughters of the Catholic Church. And it may well have been in France that Anne Boleyn got the germs of her evangelical education. But in France, as in the Netherlands, she may also have got an emotional education, because Marguerite of Navarre's writings harp obsessively on the themes of sexual violence, of women betrayed by men. It is possible that Marguerite of Navarre had herself suffered at the hands of one of her brother's gallants, a man called Bonnivet. More certainly, Margaret of Austria, during the very years, the very months that Anne Boleyn was there in the Netherlands with her, had seen her reputation suffer from advances made to her by one Charles Brandon. Now, we all know Charles Brandon in his slightly later incarnation as the man who ran off with Mary Tudor, and we only have one, but at this, you know, at this point he was still a sort of young womaniser. The only portrait we have of Charles Brandon, if you saw it, you'd understand why I'm not showing it to you. I tell you, a beard you could hide badgers in. But I am instead showing you Henry Cavill in the Tudors, forgive me, who is, of course, helpfully making play with the chessboard. And certainly he was very much supported in his attempts on Margaret of Austria by his king and crony, the young Henry VIII. But, you know, really, Anne Boleyn was hearing it from all sides. Anne de Beaujeu had written in her manual, "There is no man of worth, however noble he may be, who does not use treachery, nor to whom it does not seem good sport to deceive or trick women of rank." Margaret of Austria wrote, "Trust in those who offer you service, and in the end, my maidens, you will find yourself in the rank of those who've been deceived." That love was dangerous, that men couldn't be trusted, was a lesson Anne Boleyn could hardly fail to carry with her when she returned to England in the early 1520s. Anne Boleyn appeared at the English court as an attendant on Catherine of Aragon, who, of course, as the daughter of Isabella of Castile, had herself been born and bred into a network of female authority. I mean, really, Catherine's mother, Isabella, four surviving daughters, one of them, the eldest, Juana the Mad, as history knows her, rightly or wrongly, would inherit Isabella's throne. Catherine was the youngest. Two others were married in succession to the same man, King Manuel of Portugal, who then, after they'd both died, married one of their nieces, while the niece's sister was married to the heir's brother. I mean, there is a reason the Habsburgs have their inbred jaw. There is a reason I have my grey hairs. But I do have to do this family tree. But I do also think, don't you, this must have affected Catherine of Aragon's attitude. Because when Henry VIII came to her, surely, saying, you know, our marriage is invalid because you were married to my brother, she must have been, yeah, and your point is, have you seen my family tree? No, I'll skip on a little through, actually. I'm going to passing by Scotland, as it were. Catherine of Aragon, of course, was already sister-in-law to Margaret of Austria through Margaret's, you know, that short-lived marriage to the Spanish prince. And this was about to come into play because when the question of the divorce came between Henry VIII and Catherine of Aragon, it was Margaret of Austria who found Catherine lawyers. Catherine of Aragon wrote to Margaret saying that no one in England dared help her and that she was going to have to go into the Blackfriars hearing, a Victorian painting of which we have here, completely unsupported. Margaret sent her counsel, even though in those very same weeks, Margaret was busy negotiating the so-called Ladies' Peace, the Peace of Cambrai, with her former playmate, Louise of Savoy. When Anne Boleyn had first begun romancing with Henry VIII, of course, that all lay ahead. When Anne Boleyn first appeared at the English court, Henry and Catherine's marriage was still steady. It had, however, produced only a daughter, Mary, and was that what paved the way for Anne Boleyn? Maybe. Because there were several different elements to this love story. We all want to know, don't we, what was really happening between Henry VIII and Anne Boleyn. Sorry, we're never going to. Pending, you know, a completely undreamt of cache of letters. But we do know that there were several different elements to it. One, of course, was the personal. When Anne appeared back at the English court, her Frenchified ways made her at once a star and a quarry for the male courtiers and the man who led them. Henry's letters to her, we have his writing desk here, after their courtship began in about 1525, are full of the tropes of court, the patterns of courtly love. You know, the cruel mistress, the servant, you know, who was forever yearning. And we have some evidence of this courtship. Here we have the Book of Hours with Anne writing in it, you know, by daily proof you shall me find to be to you both loving and kind. So there was the personal element. There was what you might call the progenitorial, Henry VIII's desire for a son. But I think there was also a political element to this love story. I mean, if you're writing on a figure as well known as Anne Boleyn, in a way you need a theory, and this is mine. Because the Anne Boleyn who returned to England from the French court had so thoroughly taken that country to her heart as to seem, one diplomat wrote, a native-born Frenchwoman. And, you know, the imperial ambassador, Chapuys, could write that it was her influence on Henry VIII on which alone depended the credit and favour the French enjoy at this court. When Henry accompanied Anne to Calais, this is actually an illustration. Oh, sorry, no, I knew I'd do that at some point. From the Field of Cloth of Gold some years earlier, but it shows the kind of, you know, scale of these festivities. There were even rumours that Anne and Henry would marry there in Calais with King François to give the bride away. But if Anne's French background played a part in her rise, it meant, you know, meaning all, that she could be treated almost as though she were a French princess when an alliance with France seemed valuable, I'd say it also played a part in her fall. And of course, you know, there we have the figure of Cromwell, one we all know from Wolf Hall. Because Catherine of Aragon's stock in England had always gone up and down with the desirability or otherwise of an alliance with the Spanish Habsburgs, which she represented. For much of Henry and Anne's brief marriage, the discarded figure of Catherine made a Habsburg alliance impossible, because how could Henry possibly cozy up to Charles V while continuing to repudiate Charles's aunt? But when, early weeks of 1536, Catherine died, and when at the same time an alliance with the Habsburgs seemed once more useful, then it was the Francophile Anne who stood in the way. And Anne, unlike Catherine, had at the end of the day no powerful European family to protect her from her enemies. The game of chess, the new rules of the game of chess, one of them at this point was that a pawn that made it to the enemy's back row could operate with the powers of a queen from then on, could be queened, as they say. To me, Anne Boleyn was in many ways a pawn queened. And at the end of the day, she didn't have the backup. She wasn't part of the great club of European royalty. We all know what happened next, of the accusations, almost certainly unfounded, of adultery and treachery against Anne, of her execution. By the time Anne Boleyn knelt in the straw for the executioner's sword, by the time Catherine of Aragon died, most of the women who'd mentored them were themselves dead. Isabella, Margaret, Louise. Marguerite of Navarre lived on, but her influence was passing. But if earlier generations had gone, their daughters, literal or metaphorical, would take up the story. And I always feel so sorry for you at this point. Just when you thought it was safe to go back in the water, you'd got to grips with one lot. Guess what? But I will be moving fast from here on. But let's just have a quick look. In the Habsburg territories, in the Netherlands, Margaret of Austria was succeeded as regent by her own niece, one she'd helped raise, Mary of Hungary, who was succeeded in the job by her niece, Margaret of Parma. In England, of course, Catherine and Anne Boleyn both left daughters. We haven't spoken about Scotland, but there too, there would be a powerful female regent. And in France, Louise of Savoy should be there. Her daughter, Marguerite of Navarre, would herself give birth to another important woman about whom you'll be hearing in a second. But even apart from those sort of those vertical lines, there were alliances and bonds here. We know, of course, Mary and Elizabeth Tudor, half sisters and rivals. We know Elizabeth and Mary, Queen of Scots. But Elizabeth and Jeanne d'Albret were close allies, both Protestant queens. And even Margaret of Parma was someone who Philip of Spain, who was once brought over to England to try and persuade Elizabeth I to marry a Habsburg prince. So, although the connections between them have got lost today, they were there. But from now on, I am just going to sort of talk about a few of the identities and let the pictures tell the story in a way. I have to for time. Here we have Mary de Guise, the regent of Scotland. And what I like about her is that she was also one of the many European women touted as brides, possible brides, for Henry VIII. Henry, rather tactlessly, I feel, said to her that he thought they should get on because they were both large in person. To which she retorted, "I may be large in person, but I have a little neck," which was after Anne Boleyn. Mary of Hungary, regent of the Netherlands, a younger sister of Charles V, who was been married off young to the Hungarian king. But when, like so many of these women, she was widowed early, she returned to her native country. And I rather like what I like about Mary of Hungary, one of the things, of all these portraits, she's the only one whose wardrobe I'd like to raid. And yet, contemporaries spoke, male contemporaries, about how she was un peu en masse, a little mannish, and about how everyone knew she couldn't possibly have children because she was far too sporty. The other thing I like about her is that her writing to her brother Charles after the execution of Anne Boleyn, after Henry VIII had married Jane Seymour, it is to be hoped, if one can hope anything from such a man as Henry, that if this one bores him, he will find a better way of getting rid of her. I believe most women would not appreciate it very much if this kind of habit, cutting your wife's head off, becomes general. Well, quite. And Mary, the other interesting thing is that Mary of Hungary found her task in the Netherlands a wearing one, particularly because the country was so often at war. And when finally, after, a quarter of a century, she resigned her post, she did so in a very interesting letter, saying that, I quote, "It is impossible for a woman in peacetime, and even more in time of war, to do her duty as regent towards God, her sovereign, and her own sense of honour. A woman is never so much respected and feared as a man, whatever her position. And this was particularly bad, she said, in time of war. And if we look at this from the Battle of Pavia, we remember that war was still, you know, then very much a hands-on business in which the male ruler was expected to lead their own troops. And, of course, that a woman couldn't do. So, as Mary of Hungary complained, you know, you got blamed for mistakes made by others. You couldn't really take any charge yourself. Mary was succeeded by, you know, by her own niece, Charles V's legitimate daughter. Another one, contemporaries. This is rather a flattering portrait. All the contemporaries make a lot of play about her moustache. And indeed, in this picture, she's seen, this is her, if I can get this, she's fishing in a river of blood for the goods of executed Protestant leaders. Because by now, of course, religious affairs were playing an enormous part in the century. They were in England, certainly. I'll skip over this because we do undoubtedly know it. But, you know, Mary of Hungary had always kept a protective eye on her cousin, Mary Tudor, before Mary came to the throne, when she was in danger. Mary of Hungary actually kept warships waiting off the Essex coast to whisk Mary Tudor away to Catholic Europe if necessary. Instead, of course, when Mary won the throne herself, it was her younger sister Elizabeth, her Protestant younger sister, who was now the one in jeopardy. And as the battle between the two, if you like, continued really what their mothers had begun. This is an allegory of the Tudor succession painted in the reign of Elizabeth, which is why she's attended by the figures of peace and plenty, whereas Catholic Mary over here is attended by the god of war. Part of the problem with Mary's reign was obviously, as far as her contemporaries thought, her marriage to Philip of Spain. And this was a particular problem for powerful women, went on being indeed, you know, long after the 16th century. The idea was, the fear was, that if a reigning queen married, who could she marry? If she married a subject, there was the risk of division and faction. But if she married, as she was expected to, a foreign prince, the idea was that he, as head of the household, might well take over her country as well as her person, which is why there was, you know, in many ways, some relief when Elizabeth came to the throne. I do like to think, however, that the arrival of the Protestant Elizabeth on England's throne, 1558, it gave a headache to a number of the theorists who had Protestant theorists who had been chuntering away for some time now about how appalling it was to have female rulers. John Knox is the best known of them, of course, but he was far from alone. But they'd all been saying this while all the female rulers were Catholic. Mary Tudor, Mary of Guise, you know, over in the Netherlands. So what were they going to do now they had a female but Protestant ruler? Backtrack hastily is the answer. And the one I love, John Aylmer, you know, actually, you know, tutor to various of the Protestant princesses, wrote that it was all fine, it was quite all right, because Elizabeth was an exceptional woman, chosen by God, unlike the bulk of women who were adultified with the dregs of the devil's dunghill. I love that phrase. But of course, you know, Elizabeth's succession gave yet another twist to what was by now, you know, becoming the very vexed story of the continent's religious history. In France, certainly, religion was the issue that drove apart Jeanne d'Albret, who we have here, and Catherine de Medici. Jeanne had inherited, Marguerite of Navarre's daughter, had inherited her father's kingdom of Navarre, and 5 years later publicly converted to the reformed religion. This did set her at odds with Catherine de' Medici, who was herself just coming out of the shadows, you might say. Catherine had been sidelined for most of her married life, as, you know, the mere fairly much disregarded wife to a French king. But when he died, just as Elizabeth was coming to the throne in England, then Catherine de' Medici would come into prominence as the mother of three successive French kings. Catherine de' Medici herself, this isn't totally her reputation, was actually something of a pragmatic moderate in religion. Certainly she sheltered the Protestant Jeanne d'Albret when the Pope tried to summon Jeanne to Rome to answer to the Inquisition. Catherine said, "No one's taking her out of my territories." But when in 1572 the two women came together, Catherine and Jeanne, it was supposed to be to celebrate, cement a marriage. Catherine's daughter to Jeanne's son, which was supposed to heal religious tensions. There's some lovely little bits and bobs from that time. I love the fact Jeanne wrote a letter home to her son saying he had to hurry up and get to the French court, but it was a terrible place he'd find. Here, it is not the men who pursue the women, but the women who pursue the men. Nonetheless, he had to make a good impression, so could he please train his hair to stand upright and make sure there were no lice in it? Any mother to any teenage son. Unfortunately, in the weeks before the marriage, Jeanne died, probably of TB, but you know, there were rumours it was from a pair of poisoned gloves given to her by Catherine de' Medici. And instead of calming matters down, the marriage became the trigger for the set of terrible events known as the Massacre of St. Bartholomew's Day. It began as the attempted assassination, almost certainly with Catherine de' Medici's connivance, of a Protestant leader, the Admiral Coligny. It became a bloodbath which extended throughout, I mean, Huguenots slaughtered throughout Paris and then throughout France for months. Many thousands died. Up here we have, that's meant to be the figure of Catherine de' Medici, gloating over some of her victims. I mean, there were appalling stories, basketfuls of babies thrown into the Seine, you know, a woman in the throes of giving labour dragged out of a window and, you know, her hands slashed off for the bracelets at her wrists. And it really was one of those days that changed the course of history. And I'm not sure whether I think that this 16th century age of queens ended then, or whether it ended 15 years later when Mary, Queen of Scots, was executed at Fotheringay on the orders of her cousin Elizabeth. I mean, you can see how the religious divisions particularly were beginning to end any question of bonds between these women. I mean, of course, Elizabeth's reign, she had the great triumph. This is the Armada portrait. Right after Mary's execution, she had the great triumph of the Spanish Armada. But nonetheless, historians now speak of Elizabeth's second reign, a final 15 years, by no means as successful as the 30 that had gone before. We have here, you know, a picture of her old age, a very sort of downhearted looking portrait, I think. It's a posthumous one. And sometimes a cushion says it all. The first book I wrote was about a woman called Arbella Stuart, who in her own day was expected to inherit the throne from her kinswoman Elizabeth I. But she didn't, of course, partly because, as this was a quote from a Venetian ambassador embroidered on a cushion I saw at Hardwick Hall, "It were much, it were too much, to have three women to reign in England one after the other, Mary, Elizabeth, Arbella." Of course, it would have been four if you counted Jane Grey. Instead, you know, the Protestant James, the King of Scotland, came to England's throne, as we know, and brought in the Stuart dynasty. But a tradition of female rule as strong as we saw in the 16th century doesn't ever altogether go away. After Elizabeth and Mary Tudor, no one could say any longer that a female ruler was an impossibility. now we're seeing once again, we've been seeing recently, England and Scotland with female political leaders. I wrote this book at a time when a woman was preparing to contest the world's most powerful office. We know what happened there. It didn't work. But nonetheless, there is still a fairly dramatic resurgence of women, women at the helm, if you like. And I would like to think that the game of Queens has still some moves to play. Thank you very much. And
well, that's it for today. But there's plenty more for you to enjoy at cvhf.org.uk or wherever you get your podcasts. Thank you for listening.